Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me? Yes, my name is Arthur White with Detroit Opera. We are thrilled that you are here for this pre-opera talk, looking at Breaking the Waves by Missy Mazzoli. You know, this opera premiered back in 2016 at Opera Philadelphia, and then it sort of packed off to Europe for a while with a new production by Tom Morris. And so it's now returned victoriously back to the U.S., which you're going to see tonight. There's a lot more things added, projections and other fantastic things. Now, we're in for a treat tonight. Normally, in our business, we don't have the opportunity to speak to our composers and our librettists. They've long since usually gone on to their eternal reward, but that is not the case tonight. We're going to be in conversation with the Gary L. Wasserman Artistic Director, Mr. Yuval Cerrone. He's going to be speaking with our composer, Missy Mazzoli, and the librettist, Royce Vavre. So let's welcome the three of them now.
All right. Good evening. Good evening. Yeah, I'm so glad to see so many people here to hear directly from our composer and librettist. Some of you might have been at a pre-show talk that we gave for La Boheme when that premiered in April of 22. And someone in the audience asked me, what do you think Puccini would have thought of you doing the opera in reverse order? And my answer was, well, you know, I can't ask him. So I guess we just have to guess what he might have thought about it. And today we have the amazing privilege to be able to ask directly to the creators of this extraordinary and extraordinarily beautiful and ravishing opera, Breaking the Waves, Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavre, who are very close collaborators on multiple projects. And I want to start by saying that, you know, Missy, I'm so proud that this opera marks, you know, a benchmark that should have been crossed many, many years ago, which you are now the first woman to write an opera for our main stage. We did have an opera by Jeanine Tesori at the Aretha Franklin, her opera Blue. That was a pandemic special. I hope many of you saw that. But you are making this making history for us by being here. And I can't think of a better composer to do that. But I also have to share that one of your colleagues has often bristled against the notion that she's thinking, people think of her as a, you know, as a female composer. Mm-hmm. And she thinks, well, I'm just a composer. You know, there's nothing about me that is about, that's, you know, about the gender. And I have to say that I sympathize with that whenever I work in Germany and I'm always called a Jewish director. And I think to myself, I think I'm just a director. I mean, I am Jewish, but, you know, like when I'm directing, I'm just directing. And so I wanted to start by asking you, you know, you've been such a trailblazer in so many ways and also made so many opportunities for so many other women, you know, in a society that is still so patriarchal and in an art form that is still so male-dominated. How do you grapple with that particular question?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you all for being here. Thank you for having us and for everybody who's involved in this production. This is the American premiere of this production, which is a huge deal for us, and we're very happy that it's happening in Detroit. You know, I used to also bristle at that label because I felt that every question was something along the lines of, how does it feel to be a female composer? And I'm just like, I don't know. You know, like, and I have so much to say that is not about gender in my work. You know, I'm in this opera alone, you're going to hear I'm grappling with big questions of what is the nature of goodness? What does it mean to be faithful? What does it mean to be loyal? A relationship with the church. And I just much rather talk about that stuff. Yes. But I also, I think as I've gotten older and I started this nonprofit called Luna Composition Lab to support young female non-binary composers in their teens. So I'm talking more and more about this, and I feel like we're just not there as a society for society to just see me as a composer. And my hope is that the young women and non-binary people that I'm mentoring will just be able to talk about their art all the time. And that there will be so many of them that it won't be an anomaly. But I accept that my role at this time in history is to speak as on behalf of women. And that's fine. I now embrace it.
Okay. Well, thank you for doing that. And so I wanted to ask you, you obviously chose an opera in which there's a very powerful and complicated woman at the center of it. And Royce, I believe the idea of choosing Breaking the Waves came from you. I was wondering what was it about this film that made you think this is going to be a great opera, and also this is a particularly good opera for our continued collaboration, you and Missy.
Well, I think that we have so many stories in us, so I think that you could make a case for pretty much any story that would be a good thing to tackle with Missy. I think that you are just a complete and utter genius, my goodness. But Breaking the Waves was a story that I found, or it found me, when I was 14 years old. I rented it on VHS at the local Blockbuster or what, how, I don't know. And it really changed my life. I had seen a little clip of it on the Golden Globes, where Jan asks Bess to take other lovers, and for 13-year-old me at that time, I just could not fathom this sort of, it was sort of queer in a way. And it just offered a perspective that I had never considered, and I needed to see that film, and I gobbled up all of the film criticism. And so it changed my life when I was 14, and then when Missy said, I really want to focus my second and third years of your composer in residence position at Opera Philadelphia, really concentrating on an operatic project, a full-scale thing, I said, I really need you to consider Breaking the Waves. And Missy said,
no.
Yeah. So a little crestfallen, but in retrospect, it feels like it was just like a hiccup. And you went home and watched the film, yeah. And it spoke to you in a different way than you had initially felt, I believe.
Yeah, and you know, it was, you know, we're best friends, and we live a mile away from each other in Brooklyn, and we talk every day. And so, you know, Royce kept bringing it up, and it was an idea that just wouldn't leave me alone. And I think that when an idea doesn't leave you alone, like when you're still thinking about it 1, 2, 3 months later, like then there's something there to explore. And once I really looked at the story and kind of found my own way into it, I was like, yes, we have to do this. I'm so glad we did. I'm so glad. Yeah.
So how many people have actually seen the film? Are there any? Okay, that's more than I was expecting, to be totally honest, just because it's been a while since the movie was released. And it for some people, it is it's out there and a challenging film in so many ways. I'm just wondering, for those that haven't seen the film, could you maybe do a brief recap on the actual story?
Oh my goodness! Yes, but I also want you to come on the journey with us.
Yes, you don't have to give away the ending.
45 minutes.
Yes.
So Breaking the Waves tells a story of Bess, and she is a pious woman living in the 1970s Isle of Skye, which is on the west coast of Scotland. In the Hebrides, and she meets a charming, wonderful, beautiful oil rigger, Norwegian man named Jan, and they fall passionately in love, and when he needs to go off for a month of work, she has what turns out to be another sort of mental breakdown, and she has these amazing conversations with God that you will hear and see, but she really, really yearns for the return of her husband while he's away working. And so in one of her conversations, she begs God. I think she's like 3 weeks in, and she says, God, I need you to bring Jan home. And he says, if that's what you want. And so he is brought home, but it's after an accident that paralyzes him, and thus sort of thrusts Bess on a sort of a spiritual journey, where she believes that that she can heal him through doing these sexual sort of tasks that he asks of her.
Yeah, and I think that you, I mean, that's what the story is. And, you know, it's funny that it's a piece that actually, in many ways, I feel really belongs on the operatic stage in so many ways, even though the two of you really ask your cast to go to places that I think singers don't normally go to. Is there an aspect of the movie, when you were first thinking about it, that really connected you to an operatic experience, the way that you imagine it?
Well, what initially enraptured me at 14 was the sort of the tour de force performance of Emily Watson in the role of Bess. I could not fathom that it was her debut performance on film too. She was, you know, classically trained. She certainly had all the skills to deliver that performance, but to do that on one's first try, it completely boggled me. And I knew that if we rendered her in the right way, it would just be sort of this this really juicy, important role for our light lyric soprano or to really sink their teeth into. And I think that when you give performers that to invest in like that, it just there's something that just sort of leaps off the stage and becomes spiritual in many ways. So
I agree, and I think we're so fortunate tonight to have Kira Duffy, who originated the role in Philadelphia, has joined us for this production as well, and you are all in for an enormous, enormous treat. She is a glorious performer. Yes, applause for Kira in advance. You'll all enjoy her performance so much. And how about for you, Missy? You know, I mean, Lars von Trier, the filmmaker, is really well known for not wanting to use the artifice of cinema in any way. So it's a lot of handheld cameras, normal lighting, there's no artificial lighting in his films, and really powerfully, no music that's not extraneous to the scene, except for these interludes that he put into the movie. So for you, it must have felt like a good blank palette for you to fill the story with music.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I felt that because there are these sort of like 70s rock tunes that are these interludes, but there's no underscoring. So there's nothing in the movie kind of telling you how to feel or sort of guiding you emotionally or sort of foreshadowing things. So I felt that there was space for a musical interpretation of what was going on. I also felt that, you know, I love this film. Obviously, it's one of my favorite films. I've spent years of my life bringing this version to life on stage. But I felt that an operatic version could do something that von Trier couldn't just by virtue of the genre. So, you know, opera, I think one of opera's superpowers is in the layering and the subtext. So I can have, you know, words that Royce has written saying one thing, and then the music is saying something else, and then the movement of the character is saying something completely different. So you have these like layers of psychology all the time, like from the first downbeat. And in film, you just, like, von Trier just doesn't have it in the same way. So I also think that it's a very different experience. The opera is a very different experience from the film, and we set out to make something that was intentionally very different from the film, and that was a different perspective, particularly on the main character.
And I have to say that now that I've gotten to hear the piece so often with the full orchestra, I think your ear, your orchestration, and your sense of imagination with the orchestra is so extraordinary. And probably for people hearing it for the first time, your ear might gravitate towards some of the things that are really unusual in an opera orchestra, like an electric guitar, which has a very prominent role in it. It seems to me like, you know, the way that I understand it is that, to me, it sounds like the sound of the waves, like crashing against the rocks. That's not the answer, so if it means something different for you, that's wonderful. But for me, listening to it, I think along those lines. And I'm just curious if you would give our audience maybe anything else that you've thought about in terms of orchestra, as you started to set this story into music, how you thought about how the orchestra tells best a story.
Sure. Well, in addition, there's an electric guitar, which, you know, a little spoiler alert, but the guitar appears when Bess is talking to God. So it was kind of like, I think an early press quote was like, the guitar is the voice of God. And I was like, it's not like that, but yeah, sort of. Okay. So when you hear the guitar, like, she's about to kind of go into this realm where she's communicating directly with God in this very particular way. And I won't give away how that plays out, but then also, you know, that we took a trip to the Isle of Skye as we were writing this piece initially. It initially premiered 8 years ago at Opera Philadelphia, and so before that, we took this little trip.
It was 10 years ago.
Oh my God, stop. I know. And we terrifyingly drove around Isle of Skye and on the other side of the road, and we should not have been allowed to do that, but it all worked out. And what struck me about the landscape of Scotland, it was my first time in Scotland, and there's such a sort of violence to the landscape and a contrast to the landscape. So it's like you have these like lush rolling meadows, and then it like plunges off a cliff into the ocean, you know, and it was just these violent extremes, or like a rock formation kind of jutting out of a field. And I just thought, you know, this, I need to somehow paint the literal landscape of this space, because we wanted to firmly set it in Scotland. So the first chord that you hear are those rock formations. It is the landscape of Scotland, the landscape particularly of Isle of Skye, and these contrasts and these violent contrasts kind of taking shape through the orchestra.
Beautiful. And for the two of you, as you were developing the piece, you know, how did the back and forth go? If you can give us a little peek inside the studio, how did that develop into what we're going to see tonight?
Well, we had the great fortune of writing an opera before this as well, so we had a working relationship already. We were blessed with a very luxurious developmental sort of schedule, in the sense that we got to workshop each act separately. And then when we did Act Two, you had orchestrated Act One, so you were able to hear orchestrational ideas for previous material. But Missy, being the composer in residence at Opera Philadelphia, we really had an amazing amount of resources from that institution, and so we got to even do like an experimental vocal workshop, which was amazing. And Eve Gigliotti, who played the role of Dodo in our world premiere, was part of that very, very, very first workshop. So it feels like it. Breaking the Waves has a pretty monumentally awesome family with all of the artists who have engaged with this piece over the past 10 years, over 10 years. And it's yes, it's taken us all over the world, which is really, really exciting. But it's so great to be back in the United States. It's really, we thank you so much for bringing us home.
I'm so glad to do so. I'm so very glad to do so. And it leads me to my next question for the two of you, which is, it has been such an enormous success, winning awards everywhere and winning many, many fans everywhere it has performed. What's this experience like for you when you were at the dress rehearsal? Now it's been almost 10 years since the Philadelphia premiere. How has the piece evolved for you over these years? Like, how, I mean, especially seeing it in different productions the way that you have, I'd be very curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's really moving seeing Keira Duffy do the role of Bess. Yeah, I wrote it for her. I wrote it for her voice. We were in the trenches together at Opera Philadelphia. We had like 13 days to put it together, which, you know, I think we could pull off now, but we didn't even know what it was at that point. And with our original director, James Darrah, really everyone there did a heroic job, and Keira was an essential part of that. So it's amazing to see 8 years later, both Keira and I, you know, have gone through lots of life and lots of experiences, and there's a deepening, and there's hopefully a little more wisdom there. And I see her bring all that to the role, and I when I saw it in Philadelphia, I thought this could not get any deeper. Like, she has, this is extraordinary and so raw. And seeing it at the dress rehearsal, I was like, oh my God. And I actually started crying. Royce kind of rolled his eyes at me, but like crying during the third act, because I was just overwhelmed by her performance. And I know what's gonna happen. Like, I wrote it, and I know how it goes. And I was still just like, oh my God, what's gonna happen, you know? So this has been the most important piece of our lives, I think, and it has helped us have a career all over the world. And so it's just tremendous gratitude every time it's done. It just feels like coming home, yeah.
Beautiful, thank you. How about for you, Royce? What was it like watching the dress rehearsal?
Yeah, it's always just, you find these really beautiful nuances in every time you get to experience the show, or I get to experience the show, and we've seen most of the productions. And it's really cool to get to see Tom's production and how different performers really do enlighten a character in a way that you just would never expect. There were, and I communicated this to the cast, I don't want to share any spoilers, but there were so many directions that characters were taken that were so new and interesting, and things that I had never expected to see. And it was really, really, really awesome to see the commitment of these performers on the stage. We're so excited to get to share this story with this particular cohort, because it's a really, really special group of people that you've assembled.
Well, thank you. Well, they all absolutely loved all of the challenges that you've thrown at them with this incredible piece, which leads me to a question that is maybe a little controversial. You know, this is an opera that has, as you heard, it's got very honest and very frank depictions of sex in it, and it's also got violence in it. And, you know, on one hand, that should not feel at all strange for opera, because, you know, if you love Tosca, if you love Don Giovanni, if you love all of these operas, you know, Rigoletto ends with the soprano in a bag. And, you know, literally, and singing from the dead. And actually, this opera also ends with the soprano emerging from a bag. And so, on one hand, this is a a natural evolution of opera is to still be engaging with these very difficult topics. It's funny that when you see Rigoletto, it somehow always just feels, okay, well, that must be what happens. And we don't question it quite the same way. Maybe it's because it's the Italian, maybe it's the Umpapa Verdi kind of stuff that makes you think, okay, this must be fine. But in this opera, for so many different reasons, it hits home really hard. And it makes for an evening that asks a lot of questions, including, you know, what does it mean to continue telling stories like this in which violence and violence against women are depicted? And I'm just curious how the two of you have been feeling about that over the years and seeing different productions. I think that Tom's production, I didn't see James' production in Philadelphia, but Tom's production, I think, finds it's on one hand so elegant. You'll see that it is a gorgeously designed production. And the acting that's required of it is kind of more naturalistic, which means that when there are these moments, they really are bracing. And you know, I just would love to turn it to the two of you to think about how that's, what kind of discussions you had around it, how you've been thinking about it, how that continues to resonate with you all these years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we make opera for adults, you know, like sometimes people in the past used to ask me to write family operas, and then about 6 years ago, those requests stopped coming in, like, they're like, oh, that's what you make. I'm like, yeah, unapologetically, you know, like, I tend towards the darker side in my work, and it's a way to bring about these questions. I love when the audience goes out of the theater and they're asking questions about, you know, what does it mean to be a good person? What does it mean to be loyal? What does it mean? I think in particular for me, I'm approaching this opera from the perspective of wanting to tell the story of a woman in an impossible situation. And that is very broad, but let me clarify. So Bess is a woman for whom, you know, she's surrounded by people, sometimes quite literally on stage, surrounded by people telling her what to do. You know, her husband is telling her what to do. Her mother's telling her what to do. Her sister-in-law is telling her what to do. The doctor's telling her what to do. God is telling her what to do. And the list goes on and on. They're all telling her different things. So the line of acceptable behavior that's going to make everybody happy in this town is razor thin and actually non-existent. So that is what I saw in the film when I first saw it, when with the idea of making this into an opera. And that was actually the biggest sort of in for me. I was like, oh, this is what I can bring to it, even more than Von Trier brought to this. And Tom Morris, our director, took that one step further by placing her, again, no spoilers, but the piece begins and ends with Bess singing, but it's an electronic sort of surround sound version of her voice. Like, so that came from this discussion that I had with him when I said, you know, she is at the center of this. She has the agency. And this is an experience, yes, this is fiction. Thank God. And what happens on stage is a dramatized, extreme version of something that I think women experience all the time. And that I've had infinite conversations with my mother and my sister, both of whom have seen this, who are not in the arts at all. And they live in rural Pennsylvania, but they're like, oh, I see it. You know. And so it's just, I love that. I love being able to provide a language for these experiences that are hard to talk about. Especially as a woman. I think that's what I can bring to the operatic stage. And yeah, like there is, there's violence in it. There is violence against women, but there's violence, there's also violence against women everywhere. And when that stops, like I will stop writing operas about it. But until then, I think that there's something in there that we need to face and talk about. And I don't think that it's any more violent or sexual than anything you see on TV or in Tosca. Yes. Or any of the pieces you mentioned, I was like, yep, that one, yep, and that could go on. And I think that it is, I understand that it is, it's an intense experience for the audience because it's in English, it's happening, people are actually enacting this on stage, it's not like watching TV, so I understand that that's very different, but I hope that everyone just is open to the journey.
Thank you, it's beautiful. Royce, how about for you?
I don't know that I could possibly say anything more eloquent or I also think that there is opera is about big emotions, and unfortunately death and violence sort of elicit huge big emotions, and so if we want to give these characters beautiful crazy dramatic journeys, then we have to lean into all of life's experience. And I really love what Missy says about how, you know, when the world is free from sexual violence against women and equality reigns, then we won't have to tell these stories. But for now, yeah, it's important.
Well, one last topic before we move on and let you guys enjoy a little intermission time before we start. You know, there's one aspect that I really admire about the libretto and also about how you set the libretto, Missy, which is in the depiction of Bess, in the movie, it is very, you know, I got the impression from the movie that she has a kind of mental illness. And because of that, she, in a way, hears this voice of God that we're kind of, it's kind of implied that it's an imposition from the community, as you said, potentially. It's left somewhat ambiguous in the film, but I feel like Lars von Trier is really pushing us in that direction, partially because he was really inspired by a filmmaker, another Danish filmmaker named Carl Dreyer, who had this famous film called The Passion of Joan of Arc, in which, this is from the 1920s, and in that particular film, it's the silent acting that that used to happen in the 1920s, very cartoony, very larger than life. But the central actress, her last name was Falconetti, she gave a performance that was so unbelievably transformative and really completely changed cinema based on that one performance. And Lars von Trier cites that performance as the inspiration for all of his movies. And it helps us understand why there are all of these women at the center, because they are, in a way, these kind of Joan of Arc characters. That said, the film feels really directly, maybe leans on the fact that she is not entirely balanced, and that leads her to make these decisions. I feel in the opera, it's much more ambiguous than that. And I really have to commend you on maintaining that ambiguity and without wanting to lean on one direction or another, because my guess is you probably want to leave it open to the audience to decide. But am I right about that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, yeah. I'm just like, yeah, what he said. No, but I do, that is, I think, more of a part of the film. And this is where, even amongst the creative team who created this initially, there's room for sort of different, slightly different interpretations. I've never thought that she was mentally ill. And maybe this goes back to this me wanting to tell the story of a woman in an impossible situation. If I were living on Isle of Skye in 1970s, which 1970s Isle of Skye feels like 1950s America, and my husband, who I'd waited my whole life to find somebody, I finally find this person who understands me, and he is injured after like 3 weeks of marriage and paralyzed, and I'm stuck in this place. And he's telling me to do one thing, but the church is telling me to do another. I would feel crazy. I think that sometimes, sure, she's a little bit unhinged. She's a little bit extreme, very extreme even, but her situation is extreme. And so what is mental illness? What is a natural reaction to a very pressurized, impossible situation?
Yeah, beautiful. Royce, how about for you? Was there does it lean in one direction or another, or were you purposefully kind of leaving it with a lot of potential red herrings for us to chase in the audience?
Red herrings, not so much. But I do think that an open, letting you make up your own mind as you walk out of the theater and think about this, hopefully, over the next few days. I think that it is important to not be didactic. We certainly didn't want to be heavy-handed one way or the other. And I don't know. I do think that what is mental illness? I do think that she has had a breakdown of some sort, whether she has an underlying mental illness or whether it was this breakdown that has caused her to be acting in these very peculiar ways. I think that it's exciting to see how different directors approach her mental illness and just how hysteric she is from the top, or how that grows. I think that there's just tons of ways to nuance the role, and it's been really exciting to see the different interpretations.
Wonderful. So I can see from Arthur standing that we're out of time. So yes. I just want to say that, we talk about, the two of you have talked about very, very complicated, difficult themes in this opera, but you also lavished these ideas with so much beauty and so much care, and it makes for an unbelievable opera. So if you heard all this and said, "Oh my God, we're in for a very dark evening," it is dark, but it's also absolutely a ravishing experience. And I wish you all a great time tonight. Thank you so much.
Well, bravo. So we've come to the end of our time. Help me thank our guests, Missy Mazzoli, Royce Vavrick, and our own Yuval Sharon. Thank you all so much for being here.